this morning is Virginia Department of Corrections versus Tammy Esta. I'm just going to go over a couple of things. Most of you know this. Each side has 15 minutes to argue. Appellant can reserve a certain amount of time for rebuttal. And I would like to just remind the attorneys to please sign in on the sign-in sheets if you have not done so. So, who will be arguing? Will you, Ms. Camp?
Yes.
All right. And would you like to reserve a certain portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please, for rebuttal.
All right. Will you have that 3 minutes, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you.
We're starting a little early because everyone was here, so we were trying to be considerate of your time. So I think we're not that early, but hopefully anybody who wants to hear this argument will be here.
Earlier the better, I think. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Laura Cahill, and I represent the appellant, Virginia Department of Corrections. And again, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Really, I'll just jump straight to the heart of what the two issues that we bring before this court are, is that the Circuit Court erred in imposing contempt fines because the Virginia Department of Corrections is a state agency entitled to sovereign immunity, and they did not expressly waive their entitlement to sovereign immunity, nor has the General Assembly by statute or by the Constitution expressly and explicitly waived.
Counsel, it's been my experience as a former trial judge that when a trial judge uses contempt for a remedy to get someone's attention, it's a suggestion that there has been almost a contrived decision to not adhere to the court's order. And this case has gone up and down several times trying to resolve how this issue is going to be resolved, and there seems to be, at least by the view of the trial court, some reluctance on the department to adhere to what has been said and what has been ordered. What would be your response to that? Because, as I said, I think the trial judge is pretty frustrated with the department's actions in this regard.
Your Honor, we would disagree on the facts of what the record might show between the judge and the appellee here, but our position is the record clearly shows the Virginia Department of Corrections repeated clear steps to try to comply with the court's orders. There was no deliberate and express, for lack of a better word, trying to pull the wool over the court's eyes or trying to get around what they were asking.
Would you be able to cite the department's position, as I understand it, is that because of sovereign immunity, this type of sanction cannot be imposed. If a trial court is frustrated with the actions of a party to the litigation, that party happens to be the sovereign, what resource does the trial judge have to essentially get the attention of the department in circumstances like this?
Your Honor, if you would turn to the particular statute that governs this employee grievance procedure, which would be 2.2-3006D and E, the subsection D in and of itself really is the mechanism for the enforcement of the hearing officer's decision, and that actually is what this court stated in 2009 in this case. And clearly the legislator contemplated this mechanism and these subsections to be the only remedy for enforcement of the hearing officer's decisions, which is also expressed in subsection E, which allows the court to award attorney's fees and costs if the employee substantially prevails on the merits. That in and of itself is one particular limited instance that the court is waiving. I mean, the legislator is waiving sovereign immunity and allowing attorney's fees and costs under this particular statute.
So your position essentially is that the trial court does have the ability to get the attention of the department, but not in the way that it chose to in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And it could use other mechanisms in terms of employing other contempt remedies that don't involve monetary sanctions. Sovereign immunity is really limited in this case to the fact that they can't require the sovereign without its permission to pay money, pay damages. And subsection E expressly provides an exception to that, allowing for attorney's fees.
And that's the best way the trial court would have been to compel the Commonwealth to do something if the Commonwealth is not doing it.
Under this particular statute, I would say lawfully, yes. If the General Assembly felt that another mechanism was necessary, they could create that, but they haven't thus far. And the fact that, you know, this is really sort of a matter of first impression in terms of, you know, whether contempt sanctions, you know, are barred by sovereign immunity hasn't really come up in Virginia, sort of shows that it's not really an issue, that, you know, government lawyers are held to a higher standard in terms of, you know, their duty to enforce and implement court orders.
Can I ask you a question about a totally different topic? And that is, when the department found several, it was three, correct me if I was wrong, positions that it considered appropriately comparable to put Ms. Estep in, and they sort of, they let her choose, if you will, I guess, right? And she didn't think any of them were, so she didn't choose any of them and stayed where she was. Why didn't the department just place her in one of those, as opposed to then allowing the court to say, you haven't done anything here?
Well, Your Honor, first, I believe that the option that she chose in terms of staying where she was one of the listed three options.
So, in other words, by staying there, that did it, as far as you're concerned, but not the court.
That's correct. It would be our position that, you know, the circuit court's written orders were very clear that they either had to return her to her original position or they had to put her in a comparable position.
And the department, of course, did not want to put her back in the original position for various administrative reasons.
Right, which
that would cause.
The director testified extensively about. That clearly was their last.
And that position had been filled by someone else.
Yes.
Someone else would have to be kicked out in order to put her back in, and there were problems, perhaps, of what that would do in that area at the time, practical, pragmatic problems.
Yes, Your Honor. And you ask, why didn't the department just pick one for her? Why give her these three options? And I think that sort of goes to Judge Alston's original question in terms of, you know, DOC, whether they were trying to subvert the court's orders, but really they were trying to, you know, give Ms. Estep some options in terms of where she was going to live and work and not just rip her out of where, you know, her community was and put her 8 hours halfway across the state. Its intention was to, you know, allow her to have a part of the decision rather than unilaterally just put her somewhere that they thought was comparable. I'd like to just move back to the sovereign immunity issue for a moment, if that's all right, Your Honors. That, you know, I think I've alluded to it in bits and pieces, but, you know, sovereign immunity is alive and well in Virginia, and this court repeatedly, you know, states again and again that it cannot be waived implicitly, that it must come from statutory language explicitly and expressly, and that the General Assembly, you know, sort of dovetailing into that, you know, means what it says, and words that are not included or provisions that are not included are, we assume, are meant to be excluded. And in this case, there is nothing in the code that would provide for contempt sanctions against the sovereign. You know, the general contempt statute says nothing about the sovereign being subject to the provisions of that statute or monetary sanctions for contempt fines, and neither does the employee grievance statute on its own. And then I think that if your honors don't have any further questions on the sovereign immunity issue, I think that I've made some of my points about, you know, the Virginia Department of Corrections continuing to try to comply. And I know that the record, the judge vehemently disagreed with the Virginia Department of Corrections saying that we're trying to comply. But I think the record demonstrates otherwise, where Virginia Department of Corrections asked to mediate this issue, asked for the court's help repeatedly, said, you know, we'd like some guidance. This was back in the December 7th hearings, and the court refused to do so. And the few suggestions about pay ban and other things that the court said, well, you could at least do that. Well, the Department of Corrections did that within hours of that December 7th hearing. And then within hours of that had given her also, again, the three options. And within those three options says, if you don't choose, we'll choose for you. And she did choose. And at that point, Virginia Department of Corrections thought that they were in compliance. Within basically that day, or I guess within the expiration of her ability to choose. So then to come back and tell them that they're not actually in compliance months later and charge them a daily fine for not being in compliance seems unjust, I think, in the circumstances. I think that does the court have any further questions on that issue?
You want to reserve the rest of your time?
I think I will. Yes, please.
Sometimes when you hear the other side argue, it inspires you to say more, so it might be a good idea.
I'm sure she will. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, I think your question is, first, let me briefly introduce myself to the court. My name is PJ Turner on behalf of the athlete Tammy Estep. It sounds like your question is really twofold. One, were the offered positions comparable to the original position? And two, was the finding of contempt justified or supported? And as to that first issue, you have to look at what three positions were offered, okay? Judge Johnson found that that act of offering Ms. Estep these three positions was a Hobson's choice. It was no choice. A Hobson's choice. It was a false choice.
With your permission, Judge Officer, tell me the terms of the order that VDOC eventually violated, leading to the contempt. What was the order they violated?
The order that has been, the finding of contempt that is being appealed today is the February finding of contempt of the December order, which ordered that the DOC return Ms. Estep to her original position with her original pay band or to a comparable position such that she would.
Who has determined that the positions offered were not comparable?
Judge Johnson had already ruled in August of 2015 that the first position offered, the Chesterfield position, the position that Ms.
I'm talking about, there was testimony before him that all three positions were comparable. There was testimony before him by Ms. Estep that no, none of them are comparable. I mean, my whole position was unique. I want to know, where was the finding that one or none of these three positions was comparable? Where did somebody find that?
Well, in his, at the, in August.
I'm talking about the case from which this was appealed.
I understand that. I understand that. But what was the, whether the DOC, excuse me, whether the offers of Southampton and Cold Springs, whether they were in fact comparable to her original position, Judge Johnson refused to make an advisory opinion regarding that issue.
So that issue, he refused to make a finding as to whether they were comparable or not.
Correct. And they
And he did so, if I read the transcript correctly, on the theory I don't have the power to do that. What you need to do is put her in one and then run it back up and out the set. Is that what he said?
That's correct. In December, he did not have the power because what was at issue at the December hearing was simply the petition for a rule to show cause, not a petition for implementation.
About the hearing from which this appeal was, okay? Now, he said he didn't have the power to determine whether these positions were comparable or not. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. In E-Step 1, the one that went to the Supreme Court, that started this litigation, the trial court heard evidence and found specifically that the job offer was not comparable. That went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, we affirm the trial court because there's evidence in support of his decision that they were not comparable. Why did that circuit court judge, approved by the Supreme Court, have the power to make a comparable or not decision? But Judge Johnson didn't.
Well, in that situation, Ms. Estep had been transferred to a different position. And at that point, Ms. Estep petitioned the circuit court to make a determination as to whether, by doing so, by transferring Ms. Estep, they had therefore complied with the hearing officer's order.
Okay, well, how is that different from our present case, the posture?
In this case, the DOC did not transfer her to either Southampton or Cold Springs.
Well, and so she chose to be transferred to where she was.
She chose to remain there.
And she said, gee, all right, I'm staying here because it's Chesterfield, it's close to home, etc. But then she immediately says, it's not comparable.
Well,
doesn't she?
Not immediately. You need to back up. So at the February hearing, she had already, it was clear to the DOC that she would take the position that the Cold Springs position was not comparable, that the Southampton position was not comparable.
Uh-huh.
The court had already ruled that the Chesterfield position was not comparable, so it was not an act of good faith to offer her three positions that the DOC knew Ms. Estep would find not comparable.
Well, hold on a minute. Setting aside Chesterfield, wherever she was, how did the DOC know they were not comparable?
No,
how did they know that the other two places that she did not choose, how did the DOC know they were not comparable?
Because at the
What judge had ever ruled they were not comparable?
Judge Johnson had not ruled that they were not comparable, but evidence had been put on the record extensively at the December 7 hearing of whether they were comparable.
But
the problem is, and I'm trying to appreciate your response to Judge Haley's trying to get at, is that my reading of the record suggests that Judge Johnson said, I'm not going to make that decision as to whether or not the jobs are comparable. He says, I'm not going to do that. That's the job of the hearing officer. So I guess it's almost like when you talk about Hobson's choice, and if you notice where Hobson talked about horses, but we're putting a cart before the horse. How can we say the position that she was placed in is not comparable until we have an evidentiary hearing and a determination from the hearing officer as to whether or not it is comparable, so Judge Johnson can then make a determination as to whether he's going to endorse that determination by the hearing officer.
Okay. The circuit court, Judge Johnson, did have the authority to determine whether the position that she had been transferred to complied with the hearing officer's...
one that she was already in.
Right, right.
He did decide that,
but it's... it sounded from your question as if to say that Judge Johnson did not have the authority to make a comparability determination. He did. The only reason why he refused to do so with regard to Cold Springs and Southampton was that she had not been put in that position, and so he wasn't going to give an advisory opinion.
But his response was, and I'm quoting, well, we'll be able to talk about that a little later on because, and I'm quoting him, because, I mean, why do we have a hearing officer if I'm going to do that? The hearing officer said that the circuit court's duty is to implement the order of the hearing officer. And so, as I'm reading it, and help me out a little bit on this, as I'm reading it, Judge Johnson said, you're basically asking me to make determinations of things that may or may not happen. I'm going to wait until I get something from the hearing officer. And so if we look at it in that context, and I know these are difficult questions, agency cases are always difficult. If we look at it from that context, how can someone be in contempt of something that has not yet occurred?
Well, the DOC, the orders that the DOC was found in contempt of were the September order and the December order. And both of those orders directed the DOC, as the hearing officer had, to return Ms. Estep to her original position or to a comparable position.
And she couldn't go back to her original position because that had already been filled by someone else.
Right.
Okay, so then we get to the comparable position, which is obviously now the only thing that we can take a look at. When was the determination made that the position that she was placed in found to be a comparable position?
That was memorialized in Judge Johnson's August 2015 letter opinion. He specifically stated in that opinion that the Chesterfield position that she had been transferred to in April of 2015, that position was not comparable. But despite Ms. Estep having filed two petitions for implementation and two petitions for rule to show cause, since that transfer, and even though Judge Johnson had already found that that position to which she had been transferred was not comparable, as of February 2006, Ms. Estep was still in that exact same position.
By her own choice. By her own choice, she was there.
Wouldn't it have been better, to follow up on Judge Haley's point he just made, wouldn't it have been better for the Virginia Department of Corrections if they had said, okay, we're sending you to Cold Springs, or we're sending you to Southampton, where she would have had an enormously long commute or would have had to move, and then they're not in the risk, in the situation of perhaps being held in contempt, but they've moved the ball, but it might not have been the most practical way to solve the problem or help Ms. Estep.
You're absolutely right, but the DOC did not do that. They did not take any action.
My point is, if they'd done it, they might have protected themselves but made it worse for your client.
You're right. They may have. But the point is that when they offered her a choice of those positions, it was not an offer that was made in good faith.
Why do you say that? Because
if you look at the three options, the choice was either stay in a position that the court has already said is not comparable to your original position, or uproot your life, go across the state, go to one of two other positions that we know you think is not comparable. That's not an act of good faith. And plus, those orders and the hearing officer's orders did not put...
Hold on a minute. How does VDOT know they're not comparable?
Because at...
All their testimony at trial was they were comparable. Isn't that true?
That's not true. Director Clark had indicated that while the pay bands of these positions had been changed, the duties...
At the trial, the last trial, there was no testimony from VDOT that these two other positions weren't comparable?
No, that's not my position. There was certainly testimony, but Judge Johnson also heard...
I come back to... If in E-Step 1, the trial court could make a comparability or not decision based upon the evidence it heard, why couldn't Judge Johnson?
Because the DOC had not put Ms. E-Step in a different position.
That's what he held, but why is he wrong?
Because the order of the hearing officer was to do something, to act, to return her to her original position, to return her to a comparable position.
Your position isn't that is the only position that is comparable, her original position.
No, certainly not.
Well, that was Ms. Estep's position, isn't it?
No, there might be other positions out there.
No, Miss Eastup testified, my whole position is unique, didn't she? And that wasn't that her testimony?
I believe she said that at some point, but that's not...
No, she testified to that effect. Right. And that her whole position was the unique position, and there was no comparable position anywhere. Wasn't that her testimony?
I don't believe that was her testimony, but even if it was, the point is that from the time Ms. Eastep had been transferred to Chesterfield, so much time had gone by. The court had entered orders directing the DOC to do something. It had told them, look, you can't just offer her a position. At the December hearing, when it found the DOC in contempt of the September order...
To interrupt you, because your time is running. You know, in the federal government, when people are in these positions, you often see people transferred across the country. She could have been, you know, offered a comparable position at Red Onion or Wallens Ridge, if there is. I mean, she would have been 7 hours away from where she is now. But they could have played hardball like that, but they didn't. They didn't even, force her to go to Southampton, which is not nearly as far away as the ones I just referenced. So why isn't this actually a good faith effort on the Department of Corrections part here, despite what the trial judge found?
At the December hearing, the DOC had just been found in contempt of the court's order for just offering her the positions of Southampton and Cold Springs. It had just been held in contempt for doing precisely what they now claim was an act of good faith. And I think it's also important to remember that the issue of comparability is not before this court.
It isn't?
It's not. The issue is whether...
All right. The reason why it's not before this court is because the trial court refused to make a finding. Isn't that correct? That's why it's not before this court.
No, Your Honor.
We don't have a decision as to whether it's comparable or not, do we?
You're right. We don't have an order saying that it is comparable or not. However, at the February hearing, which was a hearing on Ms. Eastep's third petition for implementation and second petition for rule to show cause against the DOC, her only burden with regard to the contempt finding was to demonstrate that the DOC had not complied with the orders. And the court agreed that she had met that burden, and they have not appealed that finding that they did not comply with the court's orders. Your Honors, I see that my time has expired. I'm happy to entertain any other questions, however. May I just briefly conclude, if not?
Yes, you may.
For those reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the circuit court, finding the DOC in contempt and imposing the fine, and request that the court be remanded to the trial court for an award of attorney's fees incurred in this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Cahill, you have your rebuttal time.
Ms. Cahill, as you're approaching the lectern, throw up something, and I'm sitting and listening, and I appreciate your opponent colleagues. Circumstance and trying to answer these questions, and I'm trying to come up with terms that define the circumstances. And we're talking about comparability, but I think what your opponent colleague is talking about now is feasibility. In other words, how can we actually make something happen that makes sense? And you talked about a Hobson's choice, and actually there's authority out there as to what a Hobson's choice is in Virginia. I actually wrote an opinion talking about what a Hobson's choice is. Hobson's choice, people really don't understand. A Hobson's choice is not a dilemma. This is a dilemma. In other words, we've got a person who has been placed back in a comparable position, and what I hear the department saying, that we're trying to find something for her, and there's really nothing out there that is going to be on all fours with what she did before. Location, job status, pay grade, band, all of those things. We can't make all those things line up. Okay. How do you suggest that the department has met its obligation to make things work as far as a remedy is concerned, when it is not able to come up with something that actually is on all fours or as close to an all fours as possible in the circumstance?
Well, first, I would like to mention that I don't believe that I would characterize this as a Hobson's choice. I believe the court did, but she certainly may feel that it is a Hobson's choice, but or
Hobson's choice is no choice at all.
Right. Well, I think that that's what she was saying, that the reason I just stayed where I was on those three choices was because, you know, it doesn't even matter. You know, none of them are comparable. So I'm not going to make a choice. I'll just stay where I am. And I would like to sort of address that, you know, the court didn't make a finding that they were comparable at all. And actually, you know, the argument that the Chesterfield position that was offered was previously found not comparable is not entirely accurate. That position now was being offered at a different pay band at a different roll code, so it was different than the original.
Position. That the hearing officer is the only one that can make the decision of whether it's comparable until the person is placed there? Or do you think the trial court is there?
Do I think the trial court should have found, made a determination
the
as...
The trial court had the authority, and second, if so, should it have found whether it was comparable or not, or is that something that has to go back to the hearing officer unless the person's already in the position?
Well, I would say that based on the language of the statute, it appears that the circuit courts, without having fully briefed this issue, that you know, based on what's the subsection D, basically when the circuit court gets involved, their job is implementation only.
Well, the trial court's not there to make factual determinations. That
correct.
Is the job of the hearing officer, and it's basically a determination of the trial court as to whether or not the factual determinations are supported by the record. So the trial court is really not supposed to. The trial court in these instances is actually sort of like an appellate court.
It's not the fact finder.
Exactly.
It is not the fact finder. I think that it has been analogized to.
Did the trial court make a fact finding in each step one?
Did they, as to comparability?
Yeah.
I believe that they did, but in a different circumstances, not on these three positions that were given. Whether or not Judge Johnson had the authority and should have made a comparability finding is really kind of here nor there in this case, because he didn't. And how can you find someone in contempt for basically actions that have yet to be determined? I think that one of you had mentioned that, you know.
Your time has expired. Would you like to wrap up briefly? Opposing counsel, you have a few seconds to do that.
Yeah, I'll just be very brief. I don't want to repeat myself, but, you know, I think I beat the sovereign immunity issue as far as I can in terms of my position. In terms of the second issue and whether or not the contempt finding was improper, I would, you know, argue that the Virginia Department of Corrections repeatedly did everything that it could to try to comply with what the court was saying that it wanted. Hearing officer and the court repeatedly said.
Wrap up. I'm sorry. I said wrap up, not argue more.
Sorry. then I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cahill. I have to treat each side equally.